Welcome to St. Louis on the Air, and happy day before Christmas. I'm Don Marsh. A holiday departure today as we hope to get you in the Christmas spirit. We'll be hearing some favorite Christmas poems and stories, and some words reflecting on what this holiday should be all about. Sometimes some of us forget, but we shouldn't, because this is truly the most wonderful time of the year. You have just listened to the Ambassadors of Harmony, the St. Louis-based award-winning barbershop chorus, and the most wonderful time of the year. Director, Jim Henry, music professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. The most wonderful time of the year, and we're going to be talking about that a lot during the course of the day today. You know, since 1897, I think it was, kids of all ages have been reading an editorial in the old New York Sun. The title of that editorial, "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus." Most people know where that comes from. Children have asked that question, is there really a Santa Claus? 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon put the question to her father, and he suggested that she ask editors at the New York Sun newspaper, saying, "If you see it in the Sun, it is so." Well, she wrote to the Sun. Editors wrote back, immortalizing her question and their response.
"Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except what they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant, in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to our life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in the world. You tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, or even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernatural beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world, there is nothing else as real and abiding. No Santa Claus? Thank God he lives, and he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, maybe 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the hearts of children.
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, as read by our own Shelley Curley of St. Louis Public Radio. Perhaps the image second only to Santa himself during this season is that indomitable villain, the Grinch, as Kirkwood storyteller Ann Williams reminds us as she recites the classic story from memory.
Every Who down in Whoville loved Christmas a lot, but the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. He hated Christmas the whole Christmas season. Now please don't ask why, no one quite knows the reason. It could be that his head wasn't screwed on quite right, or it could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. But I think the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was 2 sizes too small. Whatever the reason, his heart or his shoes, he stood there on Christmas Eve, hating the Whos, staring down from his cave with a sour, grinchy frown on the warm, lighted windows below in their town. For he knew all the Whos down in Whoville beneath were busy now hanging their mistletoe wreath. And they're hanging their stockings, he snarled with a sneer. Christmas is coming. It's practically here. Then he growled with his Grinch fingers, nervously drumming. I must find some way to stop Christmas from coming. For he knew that tomorrow all the Who girls and boys would wake bright and early. They'd rush for their toys, and then the noise. Oh, the noise, 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 noise. That's the one thing he hated, all the noise, 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 noise. And then all the Whos, the young and the old, would sit down to feast, and they'd 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 feast on Who pudding and rare Who roast beast. Ah, roast beast was a feast he couldn't stand in the least. And then they'd do something he liked least of all the Whos down in Whoville, the tall and the small, would stand close together with Christmas bells ringing. They'd stand hand in hand, and those Whos would start singing. And they'd sing, and they'd sing, and they'd sing, and they'd sing. And the more the Grinch thought of this Who Christmas sing, the more the Grinch thought, I must stop this whole thing. Why, for 53 years I've put up with it now. I must find a way to stop Christmas from coming. But how? And then the Grinch got an idea. The Grinch got a wonderful, awful idea. I know just what I'll do, the Grinch laughed in his throat. And he made a quick Santa Claus hat and a coat. He chuckled and clucked, what a great Grinchy trick. With this coat and this hat, I'll look just like St. Nick. He needed a reindeer. The Grinch looked around, but since reindeer were scarce, there was none to be found. Did that stop the Grinch? No, the Grinch simply said, if I can't find a reindeer, I'll make one instead. So he called his dog Max, and he got some red thread, and he tied a big horn to the top of its head. Then he loaded some bags and some old empty sacks on a ramshackle sleigh, and he hitched up old Max, and the Grinch cried, get up! And the sled started down toward the homes where the Whos lay a-snooze in their town. All the windows were dark, quiet snow filled the air. All the Whos were dreaming sweet dreams without care. When he came to the first little house on the square, this is stop, number one, the Grinchy Claus hissed, and he climbed to the roof, empty bags in his fist. He slid down the chimney a rather tight pinch, but if Santa can do it, then so can the Grinch. He got stuck only once for a moment or two, then he stuck his head out of the fireplace flue, where the little Who stockings all hung in a row. These stockings, he hissed, are the first things to go. Then he slithered and slunk with a smile most unpleasant around the whole tree, and he took every present. Popguns, bicycles, roller skates, drums, checkerboards, tricycles, popcorn and plums. And he stuffed them in bags. Then the Grinch very nimbly stuffed all the bags one by one up the chimney. He slunk to the icebox. He took the Who's feast. He took the Who's pudding, he took the roast beast, he cleaned out the icebox as quick as a flash. Why, that Grinch even took the last can of Who hash. Then he stuffed all the food up the chimney with glee. And now, grinned the Grinch, I'll stuff up the tree. And the Grinch grabbed the tree and he started to shove, when he heard the small sound like the coo of a dove. He turned around fast and he saw a small Who, little Cindy Lou Who, who was not more than two. The Grinch had been caught by a tiny Who daughter who got out of bed for a cup of cold water. She stared at the Grinch and she said, "Why, Santa Claus? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Why?" And you know that old Grinch was so sly and so slick, he thought up a lie and he thought it up quick. "Why, my sweet little tot," the fake Santa Claus lied, "there's a light on the tree that won't light on one side. I'm taking it up to my workshop, my dear. I'll fix it up there, then I'll bring it back here." And his fib fooled the child. He patted her head, he got her a drink, and he sent her to bed. And when little Cindy Lou was in bed with her cup, he crept to the chimney and stuffed the tree up. And the last thing he took was the log for their fire. Then he went up the chimney himself, the old liar. On their walls he left nothing but hooks and some wire. And the one speck of food that he left in the house was a crumb much too small for even a mouse. Then he did the same thing to all the other Who's houses, leaving crumbs much too small for the other Who's mouses. It was a quarter past dawn, all the Who's still in bed, all the Who's still a snooze when he packed up the sled, packed up the presents, the ribbons, the wrappings, the tags, the tinsel, the trimmings, the trappings. 3,000 feet up the side of Mount Crumpet, he rode with his load to the tip-top to dump it. "Pooh-pooh on the Who's," he was grinchishly humming. "They're finding out now that no Christmas is coming. They're just waking up, and I know just what they'll do. Their mouths will fall open for a moment or two, then all the Who's down in Whoville will cry, 'Boo-hoo-hoo!' That's a sound," grinned the Grinch, "that I simply must hear." And he paused, and he put a hand to his ear. And he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started out low, then it started to grow. But this sound wasn't sad. No, this sound sounded merry. How could it be so? But it was merry, very. He stared down on Whoville. The Grinch popped his eyes. Then he shook. What he saw was a shocking surprise. All the Who's down in Whoville, the tall and the small, were singing, without any presents at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other it came just the same. And the Grinch, with his Grinch feet ice cold in the snow, stood puzzling and puzzling. How could it be so? It came without ribbons. It came without tags. It came without packages, boxes, and bags. He puzzled 3 hours till his puzzler was sore. And then he thought of something he hadn't before. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more. And what happened then? Well, in Whoville, they say, the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day. And when his heart no longer felt quite so tight, he whizzed with his load through the bright morning light. He brought back the toys. He brought back the feast. And he himself, the Grinch, carved the roast beast.
That's Kirkwood storyteller Ann Williams reciting Dr. Seuss's The Grinch. Take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear a couple of excerpts of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you. Welcome back to the special Christmas Eve edition of St. Louis on the Air. Now we have a couple of excerpts of another of the Christmas classics that comes to us from Charles Dickens. His A Christmas Carol has been with us for 170 years. It's been a holiday staple ever since, and Kirkwood storyteller Ann Williams reminds us of why as she recites from an excerpt of Stave 1, The Transformation of the Door Knocker.
Scrooge took his melancholy dinner in his usual melancholy tavern, and having read all the newspapers, beguiled away the rest of the evening with his banker's books before going home to bed. He lived in chambers that had once belonged to his deceased partner. They were a dismal suite of rooms in a lowering pile of a building up a yard. It was old enough and dreary enough for no one lived there besides Scrooge, the other rooms being let out as offices. The yard was so dark that Scrooge, who knew every stone, was fain to grope his way with his hands. Now it must be understood that there was nothing particular about the knocker, other than it was very large, and Scrooge had seen it morning and night during his entire residence in the place, and there was, moreover, as little of what might be called fancy about Scrooge as any man in the city of London. And then let any man explain to me, if he can, how Scrooge, with his key in the lock, saw on the knocker not a knocker, but Marley's face, Marley's face! It was not an impenetrable shadow as the other objects in the yard, but had a dismal light about it. It was not angry or ferocious, but looked upon Scrooge as Marley used to, with its ghostly spectacles upon its ghostly forehead. His hair was curiously stirred as if by breath or hot air, and its eyes, though wide open, were motionless. That and its livid color made it horrible. But the horror was in spite of the face, rather than a part of its appearance. As Scrooge looked upon it steadily, it was once again a knocker. To say he was not startled would be untrue, but he once again put his hand upon the key he had relinquished, turned it sturdily, and walked in. He did pause with a moment's irresoluteness, and he did look cautiously behind the door as if half expecting to be startled by the sight of Marley's pigtail sticking out into the hall. But there was nothing there but screws and nuts, holding the knocker to the door. "Pooh-pooh!" cried Scrooge, and closed the door with a bang. The sound resounded throughout the house like thunder. Every room above and every cask in the wine merchant's cellar below appeared to have a separate peal of echoes of its own. But Scrooge was not a man to be frightened by echoes. He locked the door, walked across the hall, and up the stairs, and slowly, too, trimming his candle as he went. Now you might talk vaguely about driving a coach and six up some grand old staircase, but I mean to say you could have taken a hearse and gotten it broadside up those stairs. And perhaps that is why Scrooge thought he saw a locomotive hearse going before him in the gloom. But up he went, caring not a button for that. Darkness was cheap, and he liked it. He did look cautiously through his rooms before closing his heavy door. He had just enough recollection of the face to have a desire to do that. Quite satisfied, he closed the door and locked himself in, double-locked himself in, which was not his usual custom. And thus secure against surprises, he took off his cravat and put on his dressing gown, his nightcap, and his slippers, and sat down before the fire to take his gruel. It was a low fire, a very low fire indeed, nothing on such a bitter night, and Scrooge was obliged to sit close to it and brood over it to extract any sensation of warmth from such a handful of fuel. As he threw his head back in the chair, his glance came to rest upon a bell, a disused bell which hung in the corner of the room and communicated for some purpose long forgotten with a chamber in the highest story of the building. It was with a strange, inexplicable dread that as Scrooge looked upon it, the bell began to swing. Slowly at first, so that it scarcely made a sound, but it soon rang out loudly, as did all the bells in the house. This might have lasted for a half a minute or a minute, but it seemed like an hour. And then the bells ceased as they had begun, together. They were succeeded by a clanking noise deep down below, as if some person were dragging a heavy chain across the casks in the wine merchant's cellar. And Scrooge remembered having heard that ghosts in haunted houses are described as dragging chains. The cellar door blew open with a booming sound, and he heard the noise much louder now, on the floors below, and coming up the stairs, and coming straight toward the door. "It's a humbug, I don't believe it." But his color changed when, without a pause, it came through the door and passed into the room before his eyes. The dying flame leaped up as though to say, "I know him, Marley's ghost in Fellingen. The same face, the very same Marley's, with its usual waistcoat, its tights and boots, the tassels of the latter bristling like its coat skirts, its pigtails, and the hair upon its head. The chain it drew was clasped about its waist, and wound about it like a tail, and it was made, for Scrooge observed it closely, of cash boxes, keys, padlocks, ledgers, deeds, and heavy purses, all wrought in steel. Its body was transparent so that Scrooge, in looking at the waistcoat, could see the two buttons on the coat behind. And though Scrooge looked the phantom through and through, and saw it standing before him, and felt the chilling influence of its death-cold eyes, and marked the very texture of the kerchief wound about its head and chin, which wrapper he had not before observed, still he was incredulous, and fought against his senses. How now? What do you want with me?
Much. Marley's ghost, no doubt of it.
Who are you?
Ask me who I was.
Who were you then?
In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley.
That's an excerpt from Stave 1 of A Christmas Carol, the scene of the transformation of the door knocker. Around this time of year, Anne Williams is featured at the Daniel Boone Holmes annual Christmas Candlelight Tour and the Lemp Mansion. Poet Sarah Teasdale was born in St. Louis in 1884. She is credited with having won the first Pulitzer Prize for poetry just after World War I, and she wrote Christmas Carol in 1911.
The kings, they came from out the south, all dressed in ermine fine. They bore him gold and chrysoprase, and gifts of precious wine. The shepherds came from out the north. Their coats were brown and old. They brought him little newborn lambs. They had not any gold. The wise men came from out the east, and they were wrapped in white. The star that led them all the way did glorify the night. The angels came from heaven high, and they were clad with wings. And lo, they brought a joyful song, the host of heaven sings. The kings, they knocked upon the door, the wise men entered in. The shepherds followed after them to hear the song begin. The angels sang through all the night until the rising sun. But little Jesus fell asleep before the song was done.
At St. Louis Public Radio's Martha Wegman reading Sarah Teasdale's poem, Christmas Carol, written in 1911. Teasdale was born in St. Louis and buried in Belle Fountain Cemetery. She was inducted into the St. Louis Walk of Fame in 1994. Most of us know it as The Night Before Christmas, but the real name of Clement Moore's Christmas classic is A Visit from St. Nicholas. It undoubtedly did more than anything else to create the enduring image of Santa Claus we have today. It's probably been read to more children by more adults than anything else ever written about Christmas. Our St. Louis Public Radio staff has added to those numbers. "'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
The children were nestled all snug in their beds while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
When out on the lawn, there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window, I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash.
The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave a luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer.
With the little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name.
Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen. On Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Now dash away, dash away, dash away all.
As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop, the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too.
And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof, as I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound.
He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack.
His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow.
The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed, like a bowl full of jelly.
He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread.
He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose.
He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Well, we just heard about the night before Christmas. When we come back, we'll talk about the day after Christmas. And we'll hear a song that will bring back memories for many people who ever saw the movie Meet Me in St. Louis. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. One of the most famous of the songs of the season made its debut in the movie Meet Me in St. Louis 70 years ago. Judy Garland's Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas has been a standard ever since.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas.
That's Judy Garland's Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. It's a Christmas standard that was part of the film Meet Me in St. Louis and had its world premiere in St. Louis 70 years ago. Although filmed elsewhere, the musical told the story of the Smith family as it struggled with the prospect of leaving St. Louis for New York in advance of the 1904 World's Fair. The film endures. Critic Roger Ebert once praised it as one of the most artful, moving, and exquisitely designed musicals in all of film history. While today is the day before Christmas, we're going to take a few minutes to reflect on the day after Christmas. Some years ago, I wrote a poem inspired by a young relative who looked up when the dust had cleared on Christmas morning, looking for even more presents to open. "Is that all there is?" he asked. It occurred to the adults that it was time for him to learn that the day is about a lot more than opening presents. Here's how I wrote about it in my poem, The Day After Christmas. Boxes piled high and ribbons askew, pretty paper that once had been new. The tree in the corner, the lights now turned out, the room otherwise empty, no children about. The toys they had scattered amid the debris were left to themselves, except two or three which the youngsters had taken as favorite treasures upstairs to their rooms for their own private pleasures. For mother and father, a chance to relax before putting the paper in cartons and stacks. The parents were happy with all they had done. The children tore through it, all in great fun. And if the measure of Christmas is the size of the mess, then this day indeed could be called a success. For the daughter of eight, there'd been memories born she'd carry forever of this Christmas morn. But up in his room, midst his robots and such, a boy of just 10 thought he'd not gotten much. Not enough, anyway. Not all he'd demanded in all of those appeals to Mom, Dad, and Santa. There were things that he had wanted not under the tree, so Christmas for him was not all it could be. He'd gotten his games and electronic things, well-batteried monsters with loud buzzers and pings, a Swiss Army knife, cowboy boots, and a sweater. But the little boy, Johnny, thought he should have done better. So he moped in his room and felt downright sad, even felt angry with Mom, Santa, and Dad. And speaking of Santa, now Johnny believed that over the years he'd been greatly deceived, for if Santa existed, that would have been that. He'd have gotten that TV and real cowboy hat. But no TV or hat were placed under the tree. The gifts he most wanted were just not to be. He told all who would listen what ranked tops on his list. How is it possible they had been missed? So he sat in his room with ambitions unmet and forgot all about all he did get. He grew sullen and angry and frustrated too. He pouted and blamed and felt terribly blue. He thought back on the morning and this day he anointed the worst Christmas of all. He was most disappointed. With the family at dinner, he was hard-pressed to conceal it, that feeling he had, but he wouldn't reveal it. Mom looked at Dad and one to the other. Even his sister wondered about brother. But he sat there in silence and said not a word. His father, impatient, thought this was absurd. It's Christmas, he thought, and Johnny's done well. What in the world could be causing this spell? He asked, what's wrong, son, not feeling so hot? But Johnny just shifted. He'd been put on the spot. He pushed at his food, dinner hardly completed, and he knew Dad's question would soon be repeated. He didn't wait long. Dad spelled it right out. Come on, Johnny, he said, what's this all about? So he put down his fork, and like a dam burst, he blurted to all, this day's been the worst. Dad looked at Mom and the little girl, too, and no one knew quite what to do. The heat swelled in Johnny, red covered his face. He wished none of this day had in fact taken place. He'd said what he said, and he knew he'd regret it, and he wished beyond wish that all might forget it. But the next words were Dad's, measured and strong. Johnny, he said, what in God's name is wrong? His words cut like a pin, stabbing a bubble. Johnny knew that his future held nothing but trouble. He took a deep breath. He took all the strength that he had. But he had to explain why this day was so bad. The string of his words was for moments unbroken. No one at the table could believe what was spoken. A 10-year-old boy with a room full of toys, the envy of most of the world's girls and boys, sat there full blushing in an obvious huff, and he told them quite clearly he'd not gotten enough. His father sat silent. His mother did too. Johnny shifted uneasily, wondering what they would do. He could see their unhappiness, their deep disappointment. In a voice like a whisper, Dad said, we have an appointment. I'm sorry, my boy, you feel so let down, but tomorrow at 9, we're going downtown. You must learn about Christmas, that it's not all receiving, that Christmas is love, it's giving, believing. You've been misdirected, and it saddens me, son. Perhaps it's the job your mother and I've done. You have more than most, and today you got more. I'm tempted to take it all back to the store. You're missing the point, son, about what this day's about. Tomorrow at 9, you and I will go out. No more was said. Dinner ended in gloom, and Johnny was happy to slink to his room. He knew Dad was angry, that Mother was sad, and he knew very clearly that he had been bad. He slowly undressed, complete in his sorrow, and he wondered what Dad had in mind for tomorrow. Sleep didn't come easily. He tossed and he dreamed, but morning came quickly, too quickly it seemed. He woke, washed and dressed, and ate with the rest, and if pressed, would have gladly confessed that it was wrong what he'd said. He'd not used his head. He honestly wished at one point he were dead. The minutes passed slowly, and the clock on the wall showed no indication of movement, no, none at all. His father said little as he buttered his toast, and Mom was more silent on this day than most. It was an awful wait for a fateful date, and if time moved at all, it was slow. But the agony ended, suspense was suspended, when Dad turned to him saying, let's go. The snow squeaked neath their boots as they walked to the car. Johnny was glad that the walk wasn't far. When they pulled out in the street, he saw it was snowing, but he hadn't a clue as to where they were going. They drove mostly in silence. Not 10 words were spoken, and the little boy's wondering only was broken when Dad parked on a parking lot being cleared of the snow. Only then was it clear as to where they would go. The hospital. But why? His curiosity heightened. Then the feeling he had was the feeling of frightened. He'd seen this building before, but he'd not been inside. He knew sick people went there, and that some sometimes died. They walked from the car and approached the front door. An ambulance passed with a wail and a roar. Now Johnny was worried and wished he could run. run from his father and what Dad thought must be done. A few seconds later, they stood square in the lobby. Johnny's knees shook. They felt rubbery and knobby. He stared at the floor and wished he could holler. His father stood by and brushed snow from his collar. The flakes fluttered downward, gently striking the tile, and became tiny puddles in a very short while. But Johnny just stared, eyes fixed, pointed down. They soon focused on shoes, a pair, shiny and brown. His eyes slid slowly upward till they fixed on a face. He thought he'd be frightened, but that wasn't the case. His father was watching, then said, "Johnny, I think that it's time that you met the good Dr. Frink." Frink's eyes didn't smile as he looked at the lad. Johnny was sure Frink knew he'd been bad, but he stuck out his hand, as he'd been taught was just right, and he hoped that this stranger thought he was polite. Frink's eyes caught the father's as if he wanted to smile. His expression told Dad that he liked the boy's style, but Johnny was bashful and he didn't see. And he visibly jumped when Frink said, "Come with me." He looked at his father and Dad, nodded yes, though where they were going was anyone's guess. But the doctor and Dad, they certainly knew what lay ahead, what they all soon would do. They walked as a threesome down the long, winding halls, up some stairs, through big doors, past spotless white walls. After 10 minutes or so, when they'd walked very far, Frink said, "Johnny, do you have any idea how lucky you are? Even with Christmas that turned out so bad, it was better by far than the one my kids had. Some are quite sick and in a very bad way. Christmas for them was just one more day. Most got nice presents, shiny and new, and in a moment you'll meet one or two. But none of them got what they really had sought, because what they wanted just can't be bought." The words fell on Johnny like blows from a hammer. He wanted to talk, but he knew he'd just stammer. He looked at the doctor, his dad, Frink again. If he'd been more nervous before, he didn't know when. He could sense what was coming. He could feel the alarm. And it was at this very moment that he realized the harm and the hurt his selfishness brought, the first part of the lesson he was about to be taught. Dad put his hand on his shoulder and squeezed once or twice, and Johnny would always remember how it felt awfully nice as a gesture of confidence for one nearing his doom, and it helped as the three of them entered a room. As they stepped through the door, he hesitated a fraction, for there was a girl strapped and in traction. Her leg was held high by long wires and bars. Her secret concern was that there would be scars. For Jenny, her name was, had come to believe that her dreams of the dance were dashed Christmas Eve. A fall in her house in an unusual way had caused her a terrible Christmas day. She was the same age as Johnny, a girl about 10, but even at that age, yes, even then, dreams of dancing on stage, film, or TV had gone to the land of might never be. During the visit, it was never made plain that she was entertaining the trio in a great deal of pain, but she smiled at her doctor, at Johnny, and Dad, and said that she didn't feel all that bad. They chatted a while and joked with good cheer, and she was the first to wish Happy New Year. As they left, she watched Johnny with the look of a gnome. "You're so lucky," she said, "to have had Christmas at home." "I know," he admitted as he pressed his dad's hand, "but you'll soon be home and it'll be grand." They waved through the door and re-entered the hall, and Johnny lamented that she'd had that bad fall. "She'll be here for weeks," said Frink as they talked. "Very bad luck," said Dad while they walked. In a few minutes' time, at a door open wide, they heard lusty laughter quite clearly inside. The doctor entered, breaking out a wide grin. The response was immediate, a chorus, "Come in." They did as was bid and all stepped to the bed. There, surrounded by pillows propped under his head, was a boy known as Billy, who hailed from a farm. And to see him and think, there's no cause for alarm. But Johnny knew better. The boy had to be ill. And as if on a signal, Bill was handed a pill. He was quite sick, though you'd be hard-pressed to know it, because neither he nor his family in any way showed it. They laughed and they shouted, and throughout the confusion, there was no way Johnny could tell. It was all an illusion, no hint whatsoever that to cure Billy's affliction would take the doctor's best work and divine interdiction. Johnny and Billy talked about the things that boys do, about football and hockey, sports they both knew. The moments passed quickly and the family joined in. People passing the doorway were impressed by the din. When the doctor achieved what he hoped to achieve, he touched the boy's shoulder, saying it was time to leave. They left the room trailed by cheers of the season, and if you'd been there, you'd have thought there's no reason to worry or fret about the gang down the hall. No reason to worry, no reason at all. But the doctor explained as they walked briskly away that Billy might never again be able to play. He'd be lucky to do anything ever with ease, for he suffered a terrible, life-threatening disease. And Frank revealed Billy's gift Christmas Day was word that extended his hospital stay. Frank bent down to Johnny, nose to nose, toe to toe. "Johnny, there's something I think you should know. Billy had just one Christmas request," he softly said, "never to return to his hospital bed. He didn't want toys, a football, or paint, just the chance to end a lifelong complaint and be healthy and strong like any young boy, a chance to live life that most people enjoy. That's all he wanted for Christmas, but he'll never get it. His family and I will always regret it. Some things, Johnny, you'll learn just aren't meant to be. And as a doctor, it always has bothered me. I can give comfort and medicine and at times reassure them, but one thing I can't do, I simply can't cure him." "But he was laughing," said Johnny. "His family was, too." "At this point in his life, it can't be easy to do," said the doctor, now upset and distressed. "In spite of it all, young Billy's been blessed. He's a giver of joy, a fine little boy. His family is wonderful, too. They have each other, kids, father and mother. Loving, in fact, is now all they can do. They have love of family and prayers on their side, but with a sickness like Billy's, there's no place to hide. So they take life as it's given, laughter and pain. And I've never heard one of them ever complain." Johnny nodded at Dad. A tear slipped from his eye. He now understood clearly that Billy might die. "Can I give him my presents? Can I give him my toys? Can I do anything for him? He's the nicest of boys." Johnny was desperate, wanted badly to give. He wanted to do something to help Billy live. Or if that was impossible, to help make life more pleasant, he'd gladly turn over his each Christmas present. Frank looked at the father and gave him a nod. "The boys learned something today, and we can thank God. A hard lesson, my son," Dad said with a smile, "one we all need to remember once in a while." Frank had planned other visits as part of the tour, but the point had been made, the response had been pure. "There are more children here, some worse and some better," and Frank asked, "What about Jenny? Did you forget her?" No, I haven't," said Johnny. "Can't I help her some, too?" Dad said, "I have an idea, son, but it'll be up to you. Take some of your toys you have all in creation and consider making some kind of donation. The sick youngsters here, some are quite needy. To have all that you have almost seems greedy. For some of the kids here, a little pleasure or laughter is all they can hope for. It's all that they're after. But it's up to you, Johnny. Do what you think best. Dr. Frank and I can take care of the rest." By now, Johnny's face was awash with his tears, for he had learned something today beyond his 10 years, a lesson in life that some never see. Some things can't be placed neath the Christmas tree. Unlike computers or hats or baseball bats, some things can't be purchased by power or wealth. As Johnny now knows, and as you might suppose, the most precious of gifts are love, life, and good health. Well, that's a poem I wrote several years ago, reflecting on the day after Christmas, which is sometimes as interesting as Christmas Day itself, especially when young relatives are not happy with the gifts that they had received. Tomorrow at this time, you can enjoy a holiday special from NPR, Jonathan Winter's reading of A Christmas Carol, hosted by Susan Stamberg. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh, and we wish you a very Merry Christmas. This is St. Louis On the Air.